Jeff is going to talk about system barriers to creating the best angio access. Dr. Sands has a unique background that I suspect that most of the audience is aware of. He was a nephrologist in the trenches like most of us for many years in Scranton, Pennsylvania. I think wrote in some of the definitive articles in terms of access monitoring using ultrasound. And he, for the last, I believe, 3 years, has been with Fresenius Medical Care as Vice President of Medical Technologies. His topic, I think, is very pertinent to this particular area. I think also something that we should know about Jeff, he actually lives in Celebration, Florida, right outside of Walt Disney World, and has a year-long pass to Disneyland and Disney World there, which is unique, I think, in and of itself. Jeff, we look forward to your talk about the system problems that we encounter in increasing fistulas in the U.S.
Thanks very much. Can you guys all hear me? I'm on the side because the Mac people took over that side of the podium and just didn't work. What Jack's asked me to do is set the stage for the later talks and talk to you about the system of vascular access care, what works, what doesn't work, and really not go through a lot of data. I'm not going to go through, normally I'd go through a lot of data. And the purpose of this is really to move on and let Alan and Jack talk about some of the specifics. So what I'd like to talk about is the system of vascular access care, where we are, what's the morbidity, the mortality, the cost, talk about the cycle of access placement, repair, and loss, and then move on to talk about some of the opportunities and barriers. I'm not going to tell you anything you don't know. What I want to do is put it all in a framework so that we have all the things on the table at the same time. So why are we talking about vascular access? Why do we care? And the reason is because, as everybody in the room is aware, access problems and procedures are at epidemic proportions. We're doing over one procedure per patient year, numbers of declots, revisions, and we have an epidemic of catheters with sepsis, hospitalization, and death. It's what we all know. It's a disaster out there. Now, if we look at the background data, and this is a summary slide from some of the DOPS work, what we can do is compare where we are and where Europe is and talk about it a little bit. Looking at the access used for the very first dialysis ever, 67% of the European DOB centers start with a fistula. 59% of the US centers start with a catheter. If you look at prevalent patients, 81% of the Europeans had fistulas, 24% of the Americans. Look at our graft rate and look at our catheter rate. If you just look at that, that sets up the problem. You don't have to go any further. If you look at the life tables, fistulas in Europe do better than fistulas in the US, and both of them do better than grafts. And if you look at the relative risk of needing a declot or revision, sevenfold higher if you have a graft than a fistula, and a procedure eightfold higher. So inherently, the problem that we're faced with is a problem of grafts and catheters. Starting up front, no matter how good you are, no matter how wonderful your care is, no matter how wonderful your team is, if you have a lot of grafts and you have a lot of catheters, you're doomed to failure. Now, how does that affect mortality risk? And this is Dringa's work, and what you can look at is prevalent and incident patients, non-diabetics, look at the catheter patients, look at the relative risk of death, 70% higher. Incident patients, a little bit. If you look at the diabetics, again, catheter patients, graft patients have a much higher risk of death. So not only are we causing procedures and multiple interventions, but the people are dropping dead. Now, this is some of Ed Lowry's data from the FMC system. And what this does is the same kind of analysis, only the other was only adjusted for case mix. This is adjusted, if you look in the red panel, for case mix and every bit of lab data and demographic data that we keep. So KT over V, body mass index, whether you're not a diabetic, what your albumin is, all those things. And the relative risk if you of death if you have a catheter controlled for everything is 1.94. And if you have a graft, it's 1.32. So inherently, we're going to have bad outcomes. Now, if I move along, there are a lot of ways to deal with the catheter epidemic because You know, we're now in a world where, as I go around the country, it's very common to see 30% catheters. I've been in units with 60% catheters. Some of them do okay for a while. Some of them have horrible outcomes. There are a lot of ways to deal with catheters. One way is to get rid of them. Second way is to see if you could do something about the morbidity and mortality associated with them. And this is from Charlene Locke, a randomized trial from Toronto, looking at what happened when they used polysporin, randomized blinded control on the exit site. Look what happened to bacteremia rates. Look what happened to survival rates. Infections dropped from 4.1 to 1.02 per 1,000 catheter days. Bacteremias dropped. Catheter removal dropped. The whole gamut. So there may be a bunch of approaches, but clearly what's going on in the catheter system is it's very unforgiving. And so very small breaks in process that you may not be able to figure out cause very bad outcomes. What does that mean to people? What it means in your unit is you've got an epidemic of disasters. If you just take that and put it in a spreadsheet and you assume 2.3 bacteremias per 1,000 patient days, catheter days, and that's about what you see in the literature, about half of it's Staph aureus, major complication, about a quarter. 14 to 44% serious metastatic complications, about a 16.5% death rate. What that means is you've got somewhere between 3,000 and 8,000 preventable deaths or major complications in a population of about 80,000 patients. In any other field but nephrology, that would be intolerable. You know, what patient are you going to say you're going to use a system and 10% of you are going to be gone next year because we're not going to be bothered with what's going on, and a bunch of the rest of you will give you valves, will deal with epidural abscess. It's not effective and is horrible for patients, and everybody in the room knows it and deals with it. The real interesting question now when I look at this is here we are 7 years after, or 8 years after Doki, and a wonderful document that talked about fistula placement, catheter reduction, location, surveillance, intervention, and we can argue about some of the details, but the Doki team did a great job. The real question is, why hasn't the care gotten better? You've got the guideline, everybody pretty much agrees, and if you look on the ground, it just flat out isn't happening. So why hasn't the care improved? Well, the first issue is the focus has been only on dialysis facilities. And the greatest improvements are from decreasing catheters, increasing fistulas. That involves vascular surgeons, hospitals, and nephrologists. There's not one nurse in one dialysis unit who can write the orders to get this stuff done, right? And again, when you try to change things, it's a lot easier to change things from an upstream problem if you deal with it upstream, not downstream. Lack of accountability. If you go into hospitals, to many surgeons, interventional radiologists, a lot of the time they don't even know what their outcome date is. How do you deal with outcomes if nobody knows what you're looking at? You know, everybody thinks they do a great job. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. Financial disincentives. Physicians, hospitals, and device manufacturers have incentives built in the system not to do the right thing. Now, dialysis facilities, on the other hand, are much more aligned with the patient. If you send a catheter patient to a dialysis facility, we lose money, right? We're much better off without a catheter. So that the system creates or rewards behavior that may not be what we choose or want. An educational deficit. Some people flat out just don't know. Now, just to illustrate financial disincentives, this slide's a little old, so it's not exactly accurate now, but it's close. If you look at what Medicare pays to physicians for fistula placement, $573 in Northeast Pennsylvania. Transposed fistula, $816. Now we're talking real surgery. A couple hours in the OR, you could really hurt somebody, right? That's not a whole lot of money for that. Look at the graft. $759, and look at the revisions. So grafts become the gift that keeps giving. They're an annuity. If you put them in, you get to do a whole lot of work. Look at catheter placement. What's that really? That makes the patient go away. That's a shift the burden strategy. You have a problem, and you just make it go away. Now, that doesn't mean you do it with everybody, but people make decisions because of real reasons. You know, when I was making rounds and when I was in practice, I knew that at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, if I started at 7, I better have the same amount of work at 1 o'clock in the afternoon that I had at 7 in the morning, or I was in trouble. Because my goal in life was to get the right date on the chart. I had to get through everybody before midnight. Well, there's so much time you can spend with every patient. If you have to see 40 patients, you know, and if you have to see ICU patients, they take a half hour. There's a certain amount of patients that you can see in a certain amount of time. You start changing your decisions as the day goes on and how you allocate your time because you've got to get the work done. Where every time you change your decision and it results in shifting it somewhere else, you wind up with a catheter. You just made a $10,000 or $20,000 or $30,000 decision for reasons that may or may not have been appropriate outside of your own context. So when I look at vascular access, what I do is I look at it as a cycle where we go from placement to maintenance to repair to loss. And once we place an access, what our goal is to slow down the cycle. You want to place it and use it forever and never have a problem. So let's talk about that and kind of dissect that cycle and talk about what's involved. When you talk about placement, first you got to identify the patient. Then they hopefully go for nephrology and CKD care because if you get them early enough, it gives you a lot more room. Then you refer them for an access placement, and then they go to another level. The surgeon evaluates them. Hopefully they place a fistula, and then there's some kind of follow-up. Well, what happens if you throw a barrier in anywhere here? It doesn't have to be all of them, anywhere. What does that do? It inevitably increases emergency access placements, right? We see it every day. We see patients who wind up in the hospital that we saw in our office but never got the access in for whatever reason. The patient didn't go. We didn't refer them. The surgeon couldn't get it together. They get an access that doesn't work, or they just show up in the ER twitching. But either way, you wind up with an emergency. And what does that do? The more emergencies you have, the more catheters you have, the more grafts you have, the less fistulas you have. It's in the structure of the delivery system. Now, if you look at that, where's the way, where do you change that? Where do you have the most opportunity to improve? Your sweet spot, your leverage point is in CKD care and in preoperative imaging. And if you do those, you get more fistulas and less catheters automatically. Who has the impact here? Who are the decision makers? A little bit in primary care, but it's nephrologists, surgeons, it's doctors. It's doctors and hospitals. It's not the dialysis facility. Now there's a caution. You know, one of the things that's going on is the network is talking about having a fistula creation initiative. Well, if you just go putting in fistulas in everybody and you don't image and you don't use your head, what can happen is you can wind up with a catheter epidemic, and you may do more harm than good by having more catheters, because having the fistula not work may not kill you, but having the catheter may. And again, it's especially if you don't do it without imaging. Now, what's the data for this? And this is some of the work from Network One looking at the first access used ever by when patients saw nephrologists. And you can see, if you were followed by a nephrologist and had a gradual, predictable progression to ESRD, 46% of those folks in New England started with a fistula. If your progression was more rapid and less planned or less predictable, 21% had a fistula. And if you showed up acutely, 2%, look at the catheter rates. All the studies, and there's a number of them, all show the same stuff. Preoperative imaging, this is Silva's paper. There's 7 or 8 other papers that show the same thing. If you do preoperative mapping, you can go from a situation where your fistula rate in his hands in Newark went from 14% to 63% by moving to mapping, looking for the artery, looking for the vein, having size and Doppler criteria. The same thing you do with carotids, the same thing you do with legs, the same thing you do with any other kind of vascular surgery. Do you need to do it every time? Maybe not. If you've got big pipes going up your arm and a great artery, you probably don't have to. But I'll let Alan comment on it, but I doubt he does very much surgery without looking. Look what happens to early failure when you do that. It goes way down. What's the secret issue with fistulas? What we all know, which is a third of them never work. A third of the fistulas don't work here. A third of the fistulas never work in Europe. If you map and you do some preoperative evaluation, you can get that number way down. And look what, this is from Gibson et al.'s paper. Look what happens when you can do the whole thing. Now granted, this was done in a VA and everybody was male, which makes a difference. but it's a nice slide, and it really shows what you can do. And I think Tony Besreb has shown similar results from his experience in West Virginia, where he was able to markedly get the fistula rate up in the 90% range. Getting to 50% is trivial. If you try, you can get to 50%. To get to 90%, you've got to do some work. And there are places where your population won't allow it. But on the aggregate, you can get way higher than you think if you try. What does that mean for cost? If you follow those leverage points, predictable stuff, and this is from Alan Collins' stuff, look at the difference in the cost of placing an access as an outpatient and an inpatient. There's only a $9,000 difference. Why waste $9,000 because you didn't plan? That's crazy. That's crazy. If there was a finder's fee, they paid a nephrologist $4,000 cash for every patient who started with a fistula, you think you'd have more fistulas? All right, let's move along and talk about maintenance. Again, the same kind of thing. You do access monitoring. That leads to imaging in a select population and elective interventions. And then on a second level, some of these folks need surgical evaluation, elective repair, and follow-up. Again, you flip the barriers in, and there are numerous barriers for this. And what do you wind up with? You wind up with more emergencies. Again, predictable interventions as an outpatient are a whole lot better for patients and a whole lot better in terms of cost. Not to mention the problem in a dialysis facility where you pin down your best people trying to make arrangements to deal with stupidity that could have been prevented. What happens when you have those? People wind up in jail. They have procedures. They have catheters. It's inevitable. It's in the structure of the system. Now, where are the leverage points? Well, the ones I chose were monitoring and elective revision, because if you do that, you get less emergency procedures. You get less catheters and less total procedures. Now, there's some caveats with that. Who impacts it? Well, here there are a lot of people who can impact it. But again, reimbursement is key here because none of this stuff is paid for. Again, who has the impact? Nephrologists, vascular surgeons, interventionalists, the hospital. Dialysis facilities are involved, but clearly are not the only focus by any means and not the greatest focus. Now, what's the caution? Technique, population, and speed are crucial. If you don't do a monitoring program properly, targeted properly, and use your head in this era, all you do is you make work. You do procedure after procedure after procedure. It's not like it was when I started and Tony started doing this 15 years ago. It's very different. 15 years ago, the incidence of access failure was way, way higher in grafts, and the type of revisions and surgery you did were different. We'll talk about that. What's the data to support it? This is Moncarly's study. And again, the reason I show this is it's easy to show, but sequential study. In this section, they did nothing. Here they did dynamic venous pressure, which every paper except one has shown is worthless. And then in phase three, they did access flow monthly. And what you could see is marked decrease in thrombosis in grafts, decrease in fistulas, increase in angioplasty rate. Not a perfectly clean study because in a sequential study, they didn't take into account the lag. Once you start doing angioplasties, there's a 3 to a 4 month lag before you see your thrombosis rate go down. Now, I should really show Bill Paulson's stuff because Bill really is the person with Jack who did all the work on looking at how well you can predict thrombosis. But I had a better slide on this paper, so I chose to show it. And what you can see in this is, looking at the receiver-operator curve, access flow was the best predictor of 30-day failure. Dynamic and static venous pressures weren't very predictive, but the area under the curve, even for flow measurement, was 0.73. And when you combine them, it didn't work. So there's been a whole series of people, some of whom are my friends to the right, we said, hey, wait a minute, is there a reason to do this? Is this an appropriate therapy, or are we just making a lot of work and not really helping patients? And I think you have to start to talk about when it's appropriate. And it has to do with prevalence and incidence. And again, I'm mathematically impaired, so I'm not going to show you the way Nikolai Krivitsky would show it. I'm just going to show you what happens. What happens if you have a test that's 80% sensitive and 80% specific? So like a static venous pressure. And what if your prevalence of disease is 800 cases per 1,000? That's the clotting rate now in grafts. What do you get? Well, you're going to get, out of 1,000 people, 640 positive tests. All right? And of those people, 640 positives who have the disease, and 40 who test positive who don't have the disease, which is a positive predictive value of 94%. That's pretty good. 94% of the people I send over to Jack for intervention actually have something. I'm pretty happy with that. And I miss a bunch of people, but that's okay. I don't really care so much about my negative predictive value. What happens if I move into a different world? What if my prevalence is 200 cases per 1,000? Now that's the fistula clotting rate. Now it's all different. Now 160 out of 1,000 people test positive and have disease, and 160 test positive and don't have disease. So my positive predictive value is 50%. Now half the folks I'm sending over to Jack don't need to be there. That's a real problem. So what your target population is very important. And that's changed. Because when I started doing this, when Tony started doing this, the clotting rate in grafts was 1.5 to 2.5 per patient year. In that era, if you just tested the people who had shoes, you found a lot of disease. And if the therapy worked, you had a big improvement in outcome. In this era, you've got a target. If you target patients, as Jack did in his patients, who are repeated clotters, you're not going to have a big improvement. If your thrombosis rate is very, very low, as in the Canadian paper, where what they did is they only looked at prevalent patients, and thrombosis happens more early than late, and their clotting rate in the control group was 0.4, you're not going to have a big outcome improvement. If you're in the rest of the world where the clotting rate is 1 per patient year, you can help it a whole lot. But again, you've got to know what you're doing. And if you wait 4 weeks to do the intervention, half the things that you were going to help are gone. So there's a whole bunch of stuff going on. What can you achieve? This is what the data says. If you do access flow, you get clotting rates between 0.1 and 0.3 in fistulas and 0.2 and 0.5 in grafts. Now, I came from an ultrasound era. That was a whole lot better. When I was able to do ultrasounds, which you can't do anymore, I always knew flow. And I always knew who had stenosis. And if I wanted to look up the artery, I could. But I wasn't smart enough to. And in that world, you never sent anybody over who didn't have anything because you saw both. That's not available right now. So now we have to guess. Flow's pretty good, but nothing is perfect. And the target population matters. Importantly, you can reverse the thrombectomy-angioplasty ratio. What that means is you substitute elective procedures for emergent procedures. That's very important in a dialysis unit, right? The Monday morning when you come in and you got three call-ins, you know, there's nobody to put the patients on and two people are clotted and they're tying up the chairs and now the clock starts. You've got 3.5 hours to clear that chair. You've got to get those folks out of there. Now, when I was making rounds, I never wanted to hear about things Monday morning, right? I only wanted to see people who couldn't breathe before noon on Monday morning. So if they called me, right, what did I do? My behavior was make it go away. That's exactly the wrong decision. You get a call 6 o'clock on Monday morning, you're in the shower, you make a $10,000 decision that's based on how quick can I get off the phone so I can finish taking a shower. You know, that's what's going on, and it doesn't have to happen often. How about repair? Identify the pathology, repair the lesions, confirm improvement, evaluate for a fistula, have a plan. If you've got a plan on the chart, when they call you at 6 in the morning, go, oh, Charlie's clotted. What does it say on the plan? Send to surgery, needs left brachial fistula next time. It's a whole lot easier. Now you made a decision that made sense and you're still in the shower. Follow-up monitoring. If you put the barriers in, again, same place. Emergency procedures that lead back to hospitalization. More procedures, more catheters, less fistulas. It's in the structure. Where's the leverage points? Well, I said it's in confirming the repair, because a whole lot of repairs don't solve the problem. Either you repaired something that wasn't the cause of the problem, or you did an angioplasty and, you know, bounced open, and then it bounced back, or it called in its friends and clotted back up. And Tom Vesely, in some of his work, is finding in low-flow grafts now, a third of the people have inflow disease. Well, no, most people don't even look for the inflow disease. I didn't used to look for it. I had this psychosis. I thought that the fact that none of my patients had legs had nothing to do with the circulation in their arms, right? Just never occurred to me that, you know, atherosclerosis would happen above the waist. I don't know. Who has the impact? It's doctors. It's doctors who can have the impact. But who do we beat up on? We beat up on dialysis facilities and nurses. Stupid. Again, the impact, you got to go to the people who actually do the work. What's the caution? One of the problems when you make intervention real easy, you know, if you just call up down the street and Jack gets the thing fixed in 2 hours and I was blessed with that kind of situation, it gets really hard not to use it. And so there's a tendency in the behavior to not think and just send it down the street. And what you get is a procedure epidemic if you don't use your head and if you don't monitor the appropriateness of what you're doing. The sixth time you do the same thing, it's probably not going to work out better than the fifth. Patients with sites for fistulas. This is a study I did with Mike Lazarus. And what we did is arterial and venous mapping by Doppler on all comers in a bunch of dialysis facilities in Philadelphia, Atlanta, a couple other places. And what we looked at 444 patients. If you look at the catheter patients, 65% of them had ultrasound criteria that suggested that they had suitable vessels for fistulas. And at least, you know, at least 80% of those should work by the criteria. And if you looked at grafts, 73%. And when you looked at forearm loop grafts, 85% of those have adequate vessels in the upper arm. Well, you knew that. Because if you've got an open forearm loop graft, you got to have inflow and you got to have outflow. So the problem is it may not be in the location you want it. You may have to elevate it, play a lot of games. But there's something draining it and there's something feeding it. And this kind of strategy is being used tremendously well out in the Spokane area by Vo Nguyen. And this is some of his data on creating secondary fistulas in patients with failing grafts. And look what he was able to do with his prevalence, up to 71%. This is a really nice, nice strategy because you can't hurt anybody. You've already got the vessels, right? You've got a very high probability of success. Now let's go back and take all those things we talked about because I gave you a bunch of leverage points. Which ones are the most viable? Which ones do you have the most bang for the buck? And where it is in fistula creation. And my friends are going to talk about that much more. But you have real high impact here. Monitoring was the game 15 years ago. That was the sweet spot. We had 2% catheters, 3% catheters. Now we got 30% catheters. So although this is very useful, you're going to have much higher impact if you work on fistula creation. Repair, yeah, the best repair is the one you don't need. And as long as we remember that, you're going to have more impact here because you won't need this. Doesn't mean you shouldn't do this well. And again, secondary fistulas, very high impact. Now, many of you have seen this slide. I want to talk a little bit about process dynamics, what works. If you want to have something work, first you've got to identify the risk group. So if we're talking about smoking cessation, you find who smokes. It's really not useful to do a smoking cessation treatment program in people who don't smoke. So you gotta find who's got the problem. Sounds stupid, but we don't always do that. Then you've gotta actually get them go into the therapy. They gotta enroll. And then the therapy or the intervention has some degree of efficacy. Our system, all the stuff I've talked about, is in here, and only when you multiply across that do you get your impact. So let's talk about fistula creation. I told you 80% of patients are candidates for fistulas. Only half of them ever get sent for an attempt. And if you don't map, only two-thirds of them ever work. If you multiply that across, you get 27% fistulas. That's what you got. If you go around the country, you got 27% fistulas. That's why. Monitoring. If monitoring is 80% effective, all right, in terms of identification, and that's actually low, flows a little better, and you actually send 80% of them over for an intervention, and if the intervention works 80% of the time, which is about what angioplasty does, you get a 50% impact. That's what you see in the programs. You drop the clotting rate 50%. That's what all the literature shows. So how do we solve this? And I'm going to open the floor and give it back to my friends who are going to talk about it. One of the things we got to start talking about is what do solutions require? One of the things we got to deal with is the shifting the burden strategy. The HMO that was in my town that had the open enrollment sign up on the third floor of a walk-up worked really well. All right, so what we have to do is we have to align incentives, all right? What you got to do is you got to incent the behavior you want. You have to have financial resources to cover added costs. It can be revenue neutral. We've shown over and over and over again, mapping pays for itself, monitoring pays for itself, but the savings are in the hospital. But you never get any of that money and invest in the outpatient area. And you've got to have options for places where the services are unavailable. There are towns all over the country where the surgeon says, look, I'm not doing it. It doesn't pay me. For $500, I don't want to come in at night. I'd rather play bridge. Well, you've got to have some resource to provide where there's, of course, a court of last resort. And we've got to talk about that. So what we're talking about is going from procedures and the access process, creation, maintenance, repair, and loss, to outcomes, to trying to do well for our patients. And this is the system we got to get through. And in each of these systems, there are all kinds of incentives, and they don't necessarily align together. And they align together at different times in different ways. And so you're constantly, this is a probability distribution. You only have to have it not work for a small percentage of the patients for the cost to go through the roof. What we're trying to do is this, work out a team approach. And the question becomes, how do we do that? I'm just going to go through that real briefly and then turn it over. Well, there are minor adjustments we can make. We can change the reimbursement a little bit. We can pay for preoperative imaging. Where I came from in Pennsylvania, it was paid for, but you had to do it within 24 hours. Oh, that was great. So you couldn't do it as an outpatient because you could never get it done within 24 hours. So what it was is there are always ways to write the reg so that it looks good on paper, but you can't do it on the ground. Right? Monitoring. There's no reason monitoring can't be paid for, right? Medicare and CMS added it to the composite rate even though it hadn't even been thought about when the composite rate was set. Accountability at the source, right? What about a hospital or a surgeon where 80% of their accesses are catheters? Is that okay? Why do we tolerate that? Why shouldn't that be an accountability measure? Why shouldn't hospitals be responsible for what they let out of the door? Why are they allowed to dump the problem downstream? But if we have the problem, what do we do? What's the easiest way to create 40% fistulas in your unit? You take all the catheter patients, you put them in a bus, and you send them to Chicago. Do you want facilities saying no to people with catheters? It's inappropriate. But if you set up a program in such a way, you can incent facilities to say, I'm not taking that patient. That's not what this is about. What this is about is delivering services. New measurements. You know, we've got to talk about what we measure. And what do we really care? Do I really care if you have a fistula or a catheter? I only care if it affects outcome. And one of the problems at looking at things that are different than your outcome is sometimes the technology changes. What I'm really interested is if I can't provide enough blood flow to reach an adequacy target. That's a problem for me. I'm interested if you don't show up for treatment. I'm interested if you wind up in the hospital. And I'm interested if you die. If I have a catheter that never gets infected, that's fine as long as I can deliver adequate dialysis. Those are intermediate markers, and we may need to start to think about this. Now, just as an aside, when you talk about markers, you have to start to think about metrics in a different way. In my view, what I like to see is the purpose of operations is to drive quality, right? Because the way you set up your operations creates your quality and your quality outcome. And the purpose of your quality team is to streamline operations. And what brings that together is a metric, and you want it to be a financial metric that's also a quality metric. I'll give you an example. And it's not related to access, but it's an easy one. Reuse number. Reuse number in a reuse world turns out to be a financial metric, because if your reuse number goes down, the financial people go bananas. And it's a quality metric. Well, how's it a quality metric? Well, if I don't have a dialyzer that does the job and can be reused, that's a problem. I've got to have an inventory system. I've got to have a process control on putting up the right dialyzer. I've got to heparinize properly. You can't get hypotensive or the damn thing clots and my reuse number goes down. I've got to keep the people out of the hospital or I'm setting up machines and I'm losing dialyzers. I've got to have a takeoff process control and I've got to rinse back that dialyzer so it keeps the surface area. So what happens is you've got a financial metric that does exactly that. Operations drives quality. And my quality team then streamlines all the interactions to drive operations, and it's tied up here. That's why it works. There are a lot of those numbers, but out of all the metrics, only some work. And when you find that, you can make an industry based on it. Last thing, structural improvements, regionalization. We've talked about that. Somebody's got to be responsible in a region. It may not be enough to have each facility try and handle it. Limited capitation, performance-based measures, disease management, all have been discussed earlier this morning. We've got to really talk about the system and deal with it on a larger scale than just dialysis facility, because you're not going to fix it in the dialysis facility alone. In conclusion, we have an opportunity to improve access care. We know what to do. We all know what to do. We can decrease the morbidity and mortality and decrease the cost. But if we're going to have sustainable improvement, we've got to address the systemic factors that limit those improvements. And it can be best accomplished by aligning incentives to reward and drive outcome improvements. And we need to have everybody at the table, right? We've got to go back to our roots, and this has to be something that involves payers and facilities and physicians and patients. Hospitals, everybody's got to be at the table, because unless we have everybody at the table, it's hard to do. Thanks very much.